This is Susan Robb for Teachers for a New Era.
I'm talking with Nina Hess, who has many interesting jobs. I mean, she's the author of A Practical Guide to Monsters, which is, it's what it sounds like, but follows the New York Times best-selling book, A Practical Guide to Dragons. She's also written numerous books for early and emergent readers, and her book, Whose Feet, was named a National Science Teachers Association Recommends book. And she, in addition to all of that, is senior editor at Mirrorstone, which is an imprint of Wizards of the Coast, a company that many people know from Dungeons and Dragons and Magic cards. And Mirrorstone is a quite diverse line of fantasy for young adults and children. So, Nina, thank you for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
So first, let me ask you about Practical Guide to Monsters. Monsters in general are something that are part of people's lives, whether they're under the bed when you're a kid or something that you might dream about as an adult. So what did you look for when you were looking at monsters? What qualified a monster to make it into the book?
Oh, that's a good question. I wanted a really sort of diverse range of monsters because when we talk about monsters, we don't mean just like a furry, scary, Disney-style monster. We're talking about vampires. We're talking about werewolves. We're talking about all those great Halloween monsters like skeletons and ghosts and ghouls. And I just wanted sort of that diversity as well as just things that seemed appealing to kids. So there's one monster in there called the Odiug, which it eats trash instead of eating, you know, people. And I just thought that was a really fun monster. And also looked for sort of the visual characteristics that are very fun because the book is so art heavy. So one of my favorites is the Beholder, which is a monster that has lots of different eyes on it. And I just think it's really funny and cute. At the same time being, you know, a little bit scary, but in a fun way.
Now, this guide also helps you understand what to do about monsters, mm-hmm. gives you a little bit about where they live. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that you looked at when you were trying to get your monster's terrain figured out.
Okay. You mean in terms of reference materials? Well, a lot of the book is based on sort of the Dungeons and Dragons mythology, and it's just, it's amazing. We have just a library full of reference materials for that. And I just poured through all these books looking for interesting details in terms of, like, you know, and I was sort of looking for a diversity of facts and ways that you can defend yourself against monsters, because I think that's really fun for kids to imagine, you know, not just these monsters as, you know, things to run away from and be afraid of, but also just sort of in their imaginations to interact with. And, you know, for example, one of the monsters is a goblin, and one of the best ways to defend yourself against a goblin is to throw some money in its path, because goblins love money, and so they'll be distracted by that and run away.
Now, there are a lot of ideas about cross-cultural characters. Like, you have a Cinderella character in many different cultures. What about monsters? I mean, do you see similar attributes of monsters across cultures?
That's a good question. I'm not sure the answer. Let me think about that. I guess, well, I mean, just off the top of my head, you know, you see a lot of sort of just the things that we think of as grotesque. It's like, so you have the chimera, which is from Greek mythology, with the three-headed monster. It has a dragon's head, a goat head, and I'm blanking, a lion head? I can't remember now. Okay, cut that. trying to think, yeah, that's a good question. I'm sort of blanking on other cross-cultural examples. I mean, the dragons are obviously very cross-cultural, but that's a different book.
But the other thing, too, with monsters is, you know, that, I mean, the scary aspect, but also, I mean, some of them come out of fears people had about people, right?
Yeah, that's really true. Like, I think that one I mentioned, The Beholder, with the lots of eyes. I mean, just you have this fear of people looking at you and staring at you. And so that's one. You know, The Werewolf, I mean, that sort of goes back to the wild man and being afraid of, you know, wild creatures, things you can't control in yourself, you know, so there's lots of psychological aspects you could read into that. Yeah, so that's a good point.
Which I guess, to some degree with fantasy, you know, there are all of these elements that tap into our childhood. When you're working with different series or types of books, what are some of the things that come up repeatedly in fantasy that tie in with childhood?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's often this element of the quest. That's a theme that runs through a lot of fantasy books, and I think besides just providing a satisfying plot device, that sort of taps into this idea of kids needing to find, you know, their purpose in life, really, you know, and to sort of read about that, follow a character through doing that, and, you know, seeing that satisfying conclusion, I think that sort of soothes something in you as you're trying to find your own path on life. So that's one example I can think of.
And monsters themselves, do they turn up a lot in fantasy?
Oh, absolutely, and that's one of the fun things about fantasy. I think you get, you know, lots of different monsters to battle. The Knights of the Silver Dragon series that we published with Mirrorstone is full. Every book has a different, you know, monster character, monster villain that the kids in the series are solving mysteries that evolve these or fighting against them. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely a key aspect of fantasy.
What other things are common in fantasy? For example, you know, what does it take to make a fantasy world be believable?
Well, you often have the element of magic, and I think that's another thing that kids really, you know, adore in fantasy books. Really an important thing to make it believable is just almost to construct an entirely different world, you know, and think about details like what are people eating, what does the terrain look like, what are the important sort of social roles in this society that you've created. It's surprising to someone maybe that, you know, an author might think through all of these elements and not, you know, some things might never make it into the book, but the fact that they've actually sort of planned this all out and thought it out makes the world and the story believable. So, yeah, I think those are all important.
Yeah, I know I've talked with authors who have said, yes, I haven't put it in the book, but I do know what
yes.
they ate for breakfast.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, I hear stories they've, you know, filled notebooks full of elements about their characters or, you know, the world. And, yeah, and I never get to see that as an editor. But it's fun. I'm really glad to know that they're doing that kind of homework because it definitely makes for a better book. And you can see it in the writing, I think.
Do you think there are qualities in a writer that makes them particularly suited to writing fantasy?
I don't know. I think the main thing is having loved fantasy as a child. Candace Ransom, who does the Time Spies series with us, one of the things that, you know, she and I like to talk about are the fantasy books that we loved as children, and we often have similar ones. And I think that sort of that spirit just gets instilled in you, and then as a writer you kind of want to share that, your love of fantasy, with a new generation of readers. So that's, to me, that's one thing. I don't think you have to have loved Dungeons, you know, played Dungeons and Dragons or you know, whatever, know a lot about swords or something like that, you know. I mean, I think there's all different kinds of people come to fantasy and come to write it. So.
And there are many different kinds of fantasy, too.
Absolutely, yeah. There's the genre ranges from, like, time travel fantasy all the way, you know, to historical fantasy to, there's just, like, medieval, the traditional Tolkien-style fantasy. But, yeah, I mean, there's such a range. I think it's just a book that contains the element of the fantastic, and that's a fantasy book to me.
Now, when you're editing fantasy, what kinds of things do you find are typical, you know, things that you have to struggle with to get a fantasy book to work well?
Well, you know, I mean, it's the same thing that you struggle with all books, I think. You struggle with making the characters believable. You struggle with making sure that the plot, the arc, the narrative arc is working, and not struggle. But, you know, I mean, those are the sort of, sometimes those are the things that I fine-tune as an editor, just looking to make sure that the characters are acting in a way that actually makes sense for them and not that they're trying to fulfill something that the author wants the plot to do. And I guess with fantasy, you're also adding that layer of, you know, does this make sense within the rules of the world you've created? A lot of times we say, you know, you can't make rules and then break them because it's convenient for the story. So we have to sort of sometimes rein the authors in and say, you know, in this world, such and such happens, so, you know, you can't not let your character suffer that fate, if, you know.
And of the different kinds of books in Mirrorstone, what are your objectives as an editor for different strands within the imprint?
Well, I think we're trying to sort of present the diversity of fantasy that is available, like we were talking about, just the broad range of genres. Right now we have this time travel series, Time Spies. We have a sort of sword and sorcery medieval series called Knights of the Silver Dragon. We're coming out with Halomir, which is a historical fantasy. And we're just looking for things that maybe haven't been seen before, turn sort of conventions on their head, new magic systems. So, yeah, just something that excites us as readers, and I think that's the most important thing.
Is there anything emerging in the genre in terms of styles or interactivity or things that you see evolving potentially in the fantasy area?
I think there's definitely a trend right now with the historical fantasy. You see that'll becoming more and more popular, and I think that really resonates with readers right now. Also, the urban fantasy is another one. But, you know, it's funny, like, you look back at Aragon, which is a very traditional fantasy book, and it just exploded onto the scene, and people crave, I think they continue to crave that traditional kind of fantasy writing, too. So, it's hard to predict, you know, but, yeah, there's a lot of variety, and that's, I think it'll always be a varied genre.
And one that lasts.
Yeah, and one that lasts. I mean, fantasy has been around. It's really come onto people's consciousness with Harry Potter, but it has been a strong genre for years and years and years and years. And I think it will continue to be after Harry Potter is over.
And I think also has a lot of educational uses when you're talking about things like historical fantasy to make other things accessible maybe to kids.
Absolutely. And, you know, you look at for reluctant readers, which I know is a hot topic with educators, when you look at the reading research, they all say, you know, the one genre that they love to read is fantasy. And especially if you're looking for books for boys, that is one that will actually turn them on. To narrative fiction, it tends to be that boys prefer to read nonfiction, but in terms of if you want, you know, to expose them to fiction as well, fantasy is the way to go. And that's another great thing about the Monster Guide too, because I think it sort of blends the idea, the patterns of nonfiction with a fictional topic. And so, you know, they can take these facts and read it like nonfiction and then take it into their imaginary world and write about it and think about it and make, you know, learn the conventions of fiction in that way, too.
Are you working on any other books?
I have a bunch of manuscripts, like every writer, which I haven't really been working very hard at sending around, but yeah. As it's hard to straddle the role of editor and writer. When I come home from work, I'm just ready to relax. Yeah.
But you still send them around?
I've been pitching a couple things. Yeah, and I'm working on a nonfiction book about Maya Lin for a packager. So that's what I'm doing this summer.
And what should we look for from Mirrorstone?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What should we look for from Mirrorstone?
In the future, we're going to be, next year, we're going to be doing Magic in the Mirrorstone, which is a wonderful anthology of short stories with authors like Cecil Castellucci, Holly Black, Cassie Clare, and just sort of exposing, you know, the kinds of, the diversity of fantasy that we're going to be publishing in the future. We've got the Red Dragon Codex coming up. It's a companion to A Practical Guide to Dragons. And we're going to be launching a new series next year called The Supernatural Rubber Chicken. It's just a great humorous chapter book series that I've been working on with D.L. Garfinkel. And it's illustrated by Ethan Long. And it's just, it's hilarious. I really love it. Yeah.
So good. So that'll be a few things that we can look forward to. And well, thank you, Nina, for talking with me.
Thank you so much.